Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite football podcast, back for another week and back to dissect what has been perhaps the most manic week of draws in Champions League, Europa League and Europa Conference League history. It has been four draws that we saw on Monday, you know, and in the infamous words of Peep Show, four draws, Jeremy. That's insane. My name is Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me is our rank god, Mr. Sam Tai.
Hello, my friend.
Hello, mate. And of course, our transfer guru, Mr. Dean Jones.
Hello, mate.
Hello, mate. How are we? We all good?
Yeah, good. It was interesting yesterday, wasn't it? The draws. Obviously, we were at Live Score and doing a live show, live reaction to the draw. And we thought we'd done a good job with the first one. And and literally 2 minutes later, we're like, oh, that's not going to see the light of day, is it? That's annoying. Thought we did really well to react to that. And looking forward to Messi and Ronaldo and all the rest of it. But luckily, the second draw was just as good, if not better. And now, instead of Messi v Ronaldo, we've got like Sergio Ramos against Real Madrid and stuff like that. So it's going to be cool. It's still a couple of months away, but plenty to get excited about. And the best thing about this is we can rank it now, and we can rank it again nearer the time as well. So we can assess it at both ends.
Yeah, well, it's a nice one because obviously we talk a lot about the way that things can change between here in January and here in February, in fact. And there's a lot to get through. But we're going to start with talking about the Champions League. And then a little bit later, we're going to have a slightly brief deep dive into the Europa League and Europa Conference League. I promise you I won't do another hour. But because there's so much to get through, there's not really time for things we love. I do just want to give a really brief shout out, though, to the rain of toys that happens every single year at Real Betis. It's been a bit of a social media phenomenon over the last couple of days. But at the Via Marina every year, the last home game before Christmas, all the fans bring in soft, cuddly toys and throw them onto the pitch for disadvantaged children at Christmas time. So make sure that nobody goes without a present. And it's one of just the nice things that happens in football that I think we often forget sometimes with how, you know, strange and weird this world can be, that there are some lovely things that happen. And the rain of toys at the Via Marina every single year never fails to bring a tear to my eye. It's a real, like, special moment. So I just wanted to shout that out before we get stuck into this draw. And with that, Sam, I'm going to hand over to you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to rank the teams. What else would I do in this scenario? But I'm going to rank the 16 remaining teams. It's not ranked on like how likely they are to win because we don't have a bracket. There's way too much to figure out from here until then. They are ranked, though, on how strong they feel right now. And that means that, as Dean said, we can revisit this in February and take a look at what's changed and who's
movers
gone up.
And shakers.
And yeah, who's gone down. So we'll do it now. We'll do it again in February. Double ranking. It's my favourite types of ranking. So we'll start at the bottom and I'm going to whiz through probably the first like 6, 8 or something like that so that we're not here all day.
I'm sure give it some context, Sam, is this going to include kind of who's drawn who?
No, it's not.
It's just where they are right now. So we're not putting, you know, the team that draws Manchester City as the bottom of the pile because the chances of them qualifying against Manchester City feel the lowest right now.
No, that's not how it's going to go at the moment. Okay. We can maybe take a look at that in February or maybe from the quarterfinal stage, but it's just too difficult to do with too much to happen and no bracket as well. We don't know who's going to draw who in the quarters, so it feels a bit of a fruitless task. So this really is on peer-to-peer strength. And we'll start at number 16, and I whizzed through the first couple at least. I'm going to go with Villarreal at 16. I'm surprised that they are here. Let's put it that way. They got two wins over Young Boys in the groups, which kind of propelled them to a point where they could then go and, to be fair, stave off Atalanta on the final game of the group stage. And I'm again surprised that they managed to do that, and props where it's due. But they've thoroughly underwhelmed me this season, to be honest with you. Injuries have definitely played a part in that. They are down in 13th in La Liga and they keep drawing games. And it's going to be a relatively common theme here at the bottom of the list, but Villarreal in 16th and Lille in 15th are two teams that I don't know if I'd back them to beat any of the best teams in Europe. Like, they might get by against the kind of Europa League standard side or maybe lower down in the table than that. But when it comes to this stage of the competition, it's tough to have faith in teams like Villarreal and Lille as well. I mean, Lille have been hit hard this season. Financially, it's been a bit of a struggle. They lost Christophe Galtier, their manager from last season. They lost Mike Maignan. Botman's been injured the whole year. So again, injuries are playing a part, but they're 11th in Liga. And every time they've played one of the best teams in France this season, they've either lost or drawn. I don't think they've beaten any of them. They lost 4-0 to Nice. They lost to Lens. They lost to PSG. They drew to Monaco. So
I'm surprised you're a little above Villarreal, to be honest. I know at the bottom, it's a little bit of a much of a muchness, but Villarreal just knocked out Atalanta, who I think are currently the second best side in Italy, and Lille are not.
It is a bit of a much of a muchness, and I did flip them around a little bit last night. But I don't know, there's like a wily element to Lille, which you never quite know on the day. Get Burak Yilmaz in the right mood. And you never quite know. With Villarreal, I feel like they're just a bit flatter coming into this kind of scenario.
They are champions as well, given that.
And they are Villarreal champions. Won the Europa League.
No one watches that.
I knew as soon as I said that, I should have said it. It was one of those, wasn't it?
Huge mistake.
Absolutely.
Huge mistake. Say the Farmers League. I'm not sure what the Europa League is compared to the Farmers League.
Right, 14th. And this is where I have put Salzburg. They're the first Austrian side to reach the knockout stages, so huge congratulations to them. There's a lot of fun here. There's a lot of excitement here, but this is surely their ceiling. I mean, there's a lot of inexperience, and that probably begins to tell here. As much as it's exciting to see them, and you know, we're looking forward to seeing perhaps someone like Karim Adeyemi take on a big gun in February, it doesn't feel like they can go much further than this just because of the natural ceiling over their heads. And some people might say, well, how have you got Salzburg above Lille when Lille finished above Salzburg in the group? There's a point in it. Again, it's a much of a muchness. In 13th, I'll take Benfica, who started the season really well, won all their games, and I think have just gone a bit flat. And to be honest, Jack, you may correct me, but I just think they're very clearly the third best team in Portugal.
Feels like at the moment, yeah.
It does. And, you know, the second best team, Porto, actually aren't in this knockout stage. They didn't quite make it through because they were in that horrible group with Milan and Liverpool and Atletico Madrid. But there's something to be said for the fact that Benfica managed to kind of like, they handled Barca, really. Handled is the right word. And they beat Dynamo Kiev in the last game to make sure they got through to this point. But again, that word ceiling comes into play for Benfica. At 12, I'll go for Juventus, who don't feel that threatening, guys. I don't.
Yeah, I think he's right.
It's weird to
say. It's a bit high.
It's a weird thing to say with a team that Dybala and Chiesa are in it, but this is genuinely where I feel that they should sit. They're a bit negative as a side. They do like to try and defend one-goal leads. They're not as good defensively as they used to be, so that is a less effective strategy than before. And when Dybala's not fit to play, which is roughly half the time, seemingly, they lack a real threat, and it's all on Chiesa. And I'm not sure if they can really stick it with these guys at the top level anymore. And that's why I've got them down in 12th. Maybe they do something in January to change this, and that's part of the intrigue. But right now, I don't think Juventus scare anybody in this list that's above them. And that's probably a good barometer for where they are.
I think this is the key point, isn't it? It's about fear factor. And I think there was a sense with Allegri's Juventus the last time round, they were just inevitable. They weren't great to watch, but they were inevitable, especially domestically. And we were talking about this on Monday's Patreon podcast. We were talking about the fact that they're not scary anymore. No one's scared of Juventus. And it took that moment, you know, where they went 1-0 up against Venezia and at the weekend, and suddenly it gets to that point where they're like, oh, we'll just win 1-0. And they don't, right? And it gets to that point where you look at it and go, if Venezia aren't scared of you, then there's nobody in this list going to be scared of you. And that's no disrespect to Venezia, who are having a quite extraordinary fun part of their season here in Serie A and are punching well above their weight in many ways. But, you know, none of these sides here would be looking at Venezia and thinking, we can't beat that side. And Juventus at the moment don't feel like they have that kind of scary element to them. Now, obviously, at the moment, there is injuries. We've seen Paulo Dybala go off again. We've seen Chiesa miss a couple of games. You know, it doesn't feel like it's completely correct. But equally, even when all of them have been fit, Juventus haven't been particularly convincing. And I think this is fair enough. And maybe it's not about, you know, as you said at the start, it's not about who beats who in this round. And this hasn't got anything to do with that. But I fancy Villarreal to beat this Juventus side. If it was this game happened tomorrow, I would back Villarreal to win it. And that doesn't mean that they should be any higher in this list, because I don't think that means they're going to go on and win the Champions League. And I think if Juventus sort themselves out a little bit more, they have a much better chance of doing that, although I still think it's an incredible stretch. You know, but we are talking here about a side that I think in their current shape would go out in the round of 16.
Yeah, I mean, 2 months is a long time for Juve to sort themselves out. And ultimately, they've got like a core of a team that was part of winning the Euros in the summer. So like, we know that they've got that pedigree in there. We know that they've got the game changers in Dybala and Chiesa. And we know that they've got the squad depth as well. They're just not coming together right now. And Allegri, as a surprise to all of us really, hasn't been able to gel this team in the way that we thought they were going to. Even they found that spell where they were getting those 1-0 wins and we thought they'd found the rhythm and the pattern. And it's fallen away again. Now, in January, they're going to try and streamline this squad and get rid of some of the fluff they don't need. So Aaron Ramsey will be touted around. Rabiot will be touted around. A couple of others will too. They need to iron out this squad so they've got just the absolute quality they want and need, and try to add one, maybe two faces to just add, I guess, some competitiveness and a bit more class to the squad for not only to try and make sure they can compete in the Champions League, but obviously they, at the moment, they don't like they're finishing the top four in Italy either. So it's a big second half of the season. And this will be one of those, I think, when we get to reevaluating this before the second round, they could be big movers. You never know.
Yeah, there's a lot of growth potential here for Juventus. They're probably the first team we've discussed so far who have a lot of growth potential. And just above them in 11th is Atletico Madrid, who also have the ability, or the chance at least, to do a lot of good work in the next couple of months and massively improve their outlook heading into February. Because it seems, again, strange to say, but Atletico are the defending La Liga champions. And I've got them sat here in 11th, and I'm struggling to figure out what exactly has happened to ensure that's the case. They are stuck in a bit of a rut. I'd say they feel like a bit of a shadow of themselves, frankly. And I don't know what they're going to look like in February. But right now, again, like with Juventus, I don't think that many teams are genuinely scared of Atletico Madrid. Now, I've got them above Juventus, and that is very much on purpose. That is by design. I still think that Atletico are more of a head scratcher of an opponent than Juventus would be. I think people would still be more wary of Atletico than Juventus. But ultimately, I've got two teams here who should be in the top nine at minimum, and they're just not. So I'm excited to see what they can do over Christmas and January to figure this out.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a strange one, isn't it? Because Atleti looked so good. This squad looked so strong across the board. Now, maybe they've got too many pieces, and the problem is that the pieces are having to be rotated far too much because there are just not enough attacking spots for all the players that Simeone has at his potential. And we know that Simeone is not the greatest manager in the world at utilising attacking players, their potential, especially flair players, the likes of João Félix, the likes of Matheus Cunha, you know, who don't necessarily have the world's best work rate, although João Félix is doing his best to change that perception after running around like an absolute lunatic for the cameo appearance against Real Madrid at the weekend. There is that kind of element of, whoa, what do you do? How do you solve a problem like Atleti? And right now, I've said this before and I stand by it, right now they feel like the biggest enigma in Europe. I don't know what's wrong. with Atleti. Now, they were quite good, I'll be honest. The performance against Real Madrid at the weekend was relatively impressive as far as I was concerned. You know, there was talk of Real Madrid steamrolling them. And actually, I thought Atleti were the better side for long periods of the game, especially the first 20 and the first 20 of the second half. Basically, before Real Madrid scored both goals in both halves, Atleti were the better side, I thought. And, you know, when you're looking at that and you think about that kind of performance, especially with the performances that Atleti have been putting in of late, that's something to hang on to and something to build off now. Does it mean that they can catch up in the title race? No, probably not. But does it mean that they might be able to turn things around by February for this? Very plausibly. And I think that there is something here. It's just a question of making it tick. And, you know, at this point, I've refused to doubt Simeone anymore. I don't think he's the best in the world. I don't think he is, you know, a manager who suits every player. And I think there are certain issues that you come up against time and time again. But, I do feel like we sometimes he's doubted way too much for a manager who's achieved what he has achieved with the squads that he has had at his disposal.
Yeah, I mean, I know we're not really talking about the draw much here, but Atletico Madrid obviously facing Man United, and they'll be happy with that because they'll know it's a winnable game. And I think there were a lot of options that they could have got that I don't think they would have fancied.
They got one in the first draw, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly. And there was a reason they wanted a redraw. It was because they didn't think that first one was winnable, and they wanted Man United basically. And look, I don't think it's a given they beat Man United, but you can see why they would see that as a winnable game. And you know, we're coming down to a time now as well. Don't forget, there's no away goals anymore. So I think that that's going to be an interesting concept change in the competition. I'm glad to see it go, to be honest. I think it will make the competition better.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I do. I think it was just outdated. I just didn't feel the need for it anymore. Why do you think it was good?
Well, I just feel like there is a natural advantage to being at home second now, because if it does go to extra time, you therefore get an extra 30 minutes in front of your own fans. I actually would have been in favour of keeping the away goals rule during normal time and binning it during extra time, because I've always thought that during that last period, it felt a bit unfair because there's a longer period of time where you can benefit from a rule. But I can see why people... I just think that there's... you know, something in the fact that the game changes whether you're playing home or away. And I do agree with you that there are times where it felt outdated. And last year especially, and the year before, where the away goal rules was in effect, despite the fact that the games were being held in neutral or empty stadiums, I thought was absolutely perplexing. But now that fans are back and the effect that they can have, I do think there is something about the away goals rule that does keep these games pretty sharp, pretty on their toes. And I do think there's something that we're going to miss from not having it. I don't think it's necessarily the worst thing in the world, getting rid of the away goals rule. But if it was up to me, I would have kept it.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from. But I think where Dean comes from here is like, it is outdated in that, like, why was it brought in? It was brought in a long, long time ago, back when our knowledge of like our opponents in terms of like, if you were an English team and you were off to go and play Partizan Belgrade, chances are you didn't even know like the names of the players. Like, you had no idea what was happening. And it incentivized teams to come out and play a little bit of football when you go 4 hours on a plane to a place you've never been before.
Yeah. Was the genuine achievement to score a goal there.
Yeah, and away and home fixtures used to be in like, you know, 30 years ago in European football, it was like, well, we'll attack at home, we'll defend away, and vice versa. And it was like, they needed that to bring teams out of their shells a little bit, but the knowledge now is so strong. And there's an undoubted advantage of playing in front of a home crowd, but the game has changed significantly in terms of your ability to prepare for your opponent, so much so that I do think that that away goals rule was a little bit out. Although, Jack, you raise a good point about the extra 30 minutes. It is a fair point. Anyway, into the top 10, and this is where I've put Sporting. And I've loved watching Sporting this season, and I almost felt a little bit harsh putting them down in 10th. Lowly 10th, Sporting, they've been brilliant. But then, look, it's not an exact science in that, but like... this essentially means that, you know, however you kind of swing this, and obviously not all of the best clubs are actually present in the Champions League round of 16, but if you've got Sporting in your top 10, that means they're pretty much cemented as like a top 15 club in Europe this season. And that's a proper reality check. Like Sporting, who, you know, went 19 years without a title, couldn't get into the Champions League as hard as they tried for so long, are in the round of 16, deservedly so, and are rubbing elbows with some really, really strong teams. And I don't know, I guess as I was writing this out and as I was trying to figure out, you know, who goes where, I was just mostly just like, wow, good on you, Sporting. You've had an exceptional couple of years here to bounce back into this kind of area.
Yeah, I mean, also, I mean, what a club, a well-run club at the moment. And look, you think back a couple of years and Sporting were in the headlines for all the wrong reasons, right? There was the invasions of the training ground. There was the club president, you know, inflaming tensions between crowd and players and fans and all of the above. And suddenly in the last 2 years, Ruben Amorim's come in, 36 years old, one of the youngest managers, you know, in the Champions League in Europe, really, and has completely turned this side around. They lose Bruno Fernandes to Manchester United, who is the captain, the playmaker. Everything goes through Bruno, right? He is the entire heartbeat of this side. And yet, when he leaves, Sporting turn things around and the next season go on and win their first Primeira title in 21 years. And then they get to the knockout stages of the Champions League for the first time in over a decade, the season following. And Amorim is doing this on with a lot of players that I think it's important to point out here, with a lot of players who have come through the Sporting Academy or come through the youth systems. Now, players move around a lot under the age of 18 in Portugal, right? And there are plenty of examples of players you'll see playing for all three of the big three before they reach the age of 18. And so it's a little bit difficult to say everyone is completely homegrown, but these are players who have been brought through the academy into the first team, and we're seeing them go on and do wonderful things. When you kind of look at what Sporting squad is, how much it costs, and look, yesterday I was looking at the amount of TV revenue that the Portuguese clubs get compared to pretty much everyone else in Europe. And it is minuscule. It's such a bizarre thing that the TV revenues can be so different between different countries, especially in the Champions League. And they're working kind of against the odds, I think, in so many ways, especially in European competition. And obviously you can hark back to 2003, 2004 when Porto won this, but times changed really fast, I think, in the footballing sense. And we're looking at a very different landscape to what things looked like 15, 16 years ago. And the Portuguese clubs are always, I think, in many ways, punching above their weight, purely because I think someone at some point realized that Portugal weren't able to compete. Look, you have to look back to sort of 1998, that kind of period where Portugal were not a serious international force. And now you look at them and where they rank in the world and all of the above. And you're thinking, okay, this is a very different place. And it's because someone decided to invest in youth structures, in infrastructures, in bringing players through who could change things. And it's a remarkable achievement that they're in these conversations. And look, Sporting have been such a joy to watch. They were so good in those two games. The last couple, the games against Besiktas, where they were exceptional, and then to beat Dortmund in that game that really mattered and closed this group off. I've been so impressed with what Amorim's doing. I imagine that him, as we say, Pedro Gonçalves, João Palhinha, are all going to be in massive demand very, very quickly. And ultimately, they're going to have to bring more people through the production line to see how this goes. But they only have to look at the team that topped their group in Ajax to see how this can be a structure that works and continues to work for everyone. And long may it continue. Long may it continue.
Yeah, just to add quickly on that before we move on, like this is also on the backdrop of a real talent drain because of what happened with the tensions between the fans and the president and an invasion of the training ground at one point as well. They lost a load of players for free, more or less, due to contractual disputes. You know, Rafa Leão left, went to Lille, and Rui Patricio left, and Sporting actually lost quite a few really important players there before they even lost Bruno Fernandes, just to like contractual disputes because of what had happened. And they've managed to fight back from all of that and field a completely different lineup, integrate a load of youth, find a great manager, and rip the script up a little bit. But we'll move into the top 10 here properly, and I'm going to just go through 9 and 8 together because they feel pretty similar in the same way that Atletico and Juve ended up sort of hovering around that 11th, 12th place together. Manchester United in 9th and PSG in 8th both have that same huge growth potential between now and February. So United feel a lot like that Atletico kind of, where are we? What are we doing? Are we on the right track? Are we not? They're quite hard to gauge. I think 9th feels about right for them. I look down the list and I think I'd probably back them to beat just about, you know, Villarreal, Salzburg, Benfica, and then probably like maybe Atletico and Juve is a very even game. Sporting becomes a very even game as well. There's the Ronaldo factor. They do tend to grind these games out, even if they may look second best. So United in ninth and PSG in eighth. I don't know what they're going to look like in February. Again, it's that question of, is the last couple of weeks where they've actually looked pretty good? The performance against Club Brugge on match day six in the Champions League was really strong, really conjoined, and they've just beaten Monaco on Sunday night as well. Is this a renaissance or is it a coincidence? Is it something more or is it something to ignore? I don't know yet because I refuse to be swept off my feet by 2 good weeks when I've just watched the last 3 months of PSG. But it's an intriguing conversation there to be had. And I do wonder if they may be finding something in the absence of Neymar, which is a super awkward conversation to have for Pochettino when Neymar returns. And obviously he'll be fit and ready to go for February. So yeah, we'll have to see. But United and PSG, I think they're our final, what will they look like in February? I don't know, huge growth potential clubs. We've got 4 of them there. 4 that are just total question marks, absolute jokers in the pack.
I don't really agree with this because I think there are 6 favourites to win the competition. 4 of them are the English clubs. And there's Bayern Munich and PSG. Like, I just think that it's been since day one, like they're the 6 clubs I've been looking at as like, that's where the winner is coming from. So I can kind of understand it, like given the performances we've seen and how flaky both of these teams can be.
On talent level, you're right.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And I think that's what it comes down to now. Because we're in the knockouts, I expect these teams to rise. You know, in the groups, you know, both of them, well, PSG were probably better than United, but United's performances obviously weren't convincing, but it was a different era now. Like, we can forget about what United did in the group stages because it doesn't matter. That's not Man United anymore. So I almost think you press reset on it and kind of look at their overall picture of what the squad is, what the manager is, what do we expect from them. And I think they're in the top 6 in terms of likelihood of winning this.
Yeah, I would agree with you at the start of the year. I would have agreed with you at the start of the year, but I do think that I'd look at Ajax, I look at Inter Milan, and I look at Real Madrid, and I look at the way that they've performed, the way that they're performing generally, domestically as well, and no way on earth can I put PSG or Manchester United ahead of any of them in terms of any sort of standings.
So you genuinely think that there's more chance of Ajax winning the Champions League than Man United or PSG?
The Man United 100%, then PSG less so. But
it's an incorrect answer.
It's not, because we saw Ajax seconds away from the Champions League final a couple of years back. I think this side is.
Did they get winners medal for that there?
Well, I mean, to be fair, when was the last time Manchester United picked up a winners medal? It's 12 years ago. We just said the complete landscape of football has changed. And we're looking at that going, you know, right now, I think that Ajax would beat Man United straight up, 100%. I think Inter Milan would. I think the Real Madrid would. I think that, and look at where we are. In terms of where we are in February, I expect these standings to be slightly different, right? But if we're looking at this right now, I don't think you can put these two teams above any of the ones mentioned in terms of their performance levels or what we've seen from them throughout the season so far in either a domestic or a European sense. There's nothing to prove to me that that's happened.
You know, I mean, it's all, but look, the best thing about football is it's all about opinions and we can't really be proved right either way right now. But like, Ajax have a very different setup at the start of their season in terms of what they're aiming for and what their conditions are for success. Manchester United and PSG have the complete opposite. Like, PSG literally have to win the league or it's a failure. Man United have to be in the conversation to win the league or it's a failure, as Solskjaer's found out. And obviously Ajax do too. And at the moment, I don't think they're even winning the league as it stands, but they will win the league. Like, Ajax will win the league this season. But the Champions League is where they make their mark. Like, this is what the club's become about. So I just think the conditions are slightly different. And I just don't think that Ajax are as strong as these two teams. But like you say, like, from what we've seen so far, I'm wrong. I understand that, but
so
I don't
The problem here is that PSG have absolutely just worn me down for the last 3 months. Like, I don't enjoy
watching PSG.
Every time I watch them, I'm just like, why are you not 10 times better?
Yeah, it's frustrating watching them.
And it is so difficult for me to sit there and put them in like a top 6 position when on a weekly or bi-weekly basis, I sit there and just be like, this ain't it. This just ain't it. And like the teams above from here, so we're now into 7th place and above, all of these teams are teams. They're teams. They have an identity. They have a cohesiveness. They look like they know exactly what they're supposed to be doing on the pitch, and that's what makes them a little bit better than everybody else, in my opinion, anyway. And I'll go to number seven, and this is where I put Inter, which is a very well put together side. They've got a really tough round of 16 draw, but you never know with this team. Inzaghi's done an amazing job building off the Conte base. They've really stepped it up over the last month. They finished second in their group, so I think this is the second highest second place finisher, but they were in a tough group and they got edged out on the final match day. And I think they're a force to be reckoned with, to be honest with you, Inter. And yes, they're underdogs for the Liverpool game, absolutely, but they are a rough draw for a top seed in Liverpool, and I don't think the Reds would be too happy with that. I move just into a couple more. Ajax in six. I've been propping them up as a top five team for weeks, and I wrote the list down and somehow I've let them slip to sixth. I'm not exactly sure how that happened. I had a perfect group stage. Allaire scored 10. I think Antony and Mazraoui were the best right side in the tournament over the six games. But I guess to explain this properly, really, we then link in number five, and this is where I've put Real Madrid. Yeah. So Madrid 5, Ajax 6, and it's a recent swing. It is a recent swing. But there's just Madrid have just been on this run recently, and they've been incredible. And I just look at them, and I see a team who win. They just win, don't they? I mean, they don't always play well. Christ, they often don't play well, to be honest with you. But if you've got two attackers in the form that Vinicius Junior and Karim Benzema are in, you've got this midfield three. You've got Alaba and Militao in this form, and Courtois in goal. There ain't a lot of teams that are going to be able to beat you. And especially in this Champions League setting, there's something about Real Madrid, isn't there? There's something about them. And I've been wooed, I must admit. I've been swayed into putting them into the top five when I thought for sure that Ajax would be there, but I've just popped them in ahead. So that's Real Madrid at five, Ajax at six, and Inter Milan at seven.
Yeah, I mean, Real Madrid feel inevitable at the moment, don't they? There is that real sense of we're just going to win. And it's been perhaps missing at the Bernabeu for a couple of years, right? Where there was a couple of years in the wilderness, not that they didn't win anything, but that it wasn't quite as, well, just obvious, I suppose. And it feels like this year, Real Madrid are just back in a spot where, you know, Militao and Alaba have become a really wonderful defensive partnership who feel like they're not going to concede. Courtois is a man on a mission, and probably the form keeper in the world right now, I would suggest. He just feels like you can't get past him. You go out wide and you're looking at Ferland Mendy, who's made that spot his own, and Danny Carvajal, who's having his own little renaissance. I enjoy how he keeps popping up front during counterattacks. It's bizarre. And then, you know, there's this midfield three who just are ageless and timeless, aren't they? And it's really intriguing that Camavinga's come in, that Valverde has been, you know, given the release clause that he's been given and kind of promised the future and the keys to the Bernabeu, you know, by himself. And yet neither of them can still break the spell that these three hold over the center of the park there. And look, Kroos and Modric, Casemiro is Casemiro, right? Casemiro does what Casemiro does every single time, and he's never really fallen away from it. But I think there were questions over whether Kroos and Modric could continue to control games in the way that they used to and be able to come up with those moments of magic. And those questions have been fundamentally answered this season. The two of them just feel like Rolls Royces in there, and no one could get near them. It's intriguing to watch Real Madrid because even when they're not playing well, one of these two pops up with the answer. And I know it's Benzema and Vinicius getting the headlines, and I know it's those stories that are coming out about the fact that they used to have this relationship where Benzema was like, "Don't pass the ball to Vinicius," etc.
Well, you keep mentioning it for a start.
Well, I do, so I keep making it. It's very important, right? To talk about redemption arcs, part of my thing, right? Mm. And this is a redemption arc, but it does come up, and then you look at it and you think these two playing together now and watching them just kind of interlink, and Vinicius finally find the kind of finishing touch that had been missing from the magic up to this point. And you know what, fair play to Real Madrid for the faith that they showed in Vinicius. You know, as a youngster, yes, he was a prodigiously talented youngster, but that doesn't always work out, right? There are plenty of prodigiously talented youngsters knocking around in the lower echelons of top leagues who haven't quite made the grade to where we were expected or even below. Vinicius Junior, there was a lot of pressure on those shoulders. He came in and for ages he was, well, kind of mocked, I think, by a lot of people for not having the finishing touch, for just being all show and no kind of no end product. And this year has exploded into one of the most dynamic, exciting players to watch in Europe. And you mark that with Benzema's kind of faith and constancy and the ability he has to just put the ball in the back of the net and create things and be that kind of link-up player. And it's amazing. But it is those midfield three for me that continue to set the pace and set the tone. And right now, Real Madrid feel so, so, so smooth.
So a couple of things to just watch out for here between now and February with Real Madrid is that it's like, now obviously they have incredible footballers and great finishers, so this isn't particularly abnormal, but they are way overperforming their expected goals, like way, way, way over. And it's the sort of run statistically that if you didn't know it was Real Madrid, if you didn't know it was Benzema, if you didn't know it was Vinicius Junior in this form, you would suggest can't carry on. And you watched them in some of these games recently, second best for periods against Atletico, second best for most of the game against Sevilla, but they won them. Those are the performances that don't necessarily match up to the results. So it's just, I'm not really criticising them for it, to be honest with you, but I'd just say it's something to watch. We're talking about four teams below them there, PSG, Man United, Atletico, Juve, with a lot of room for growth between now and February. I'd say Real Madrid, and again, not really that much of a criticism, may have the most room to just drop down a level or two between now and February, but I don't know what will happen.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Madrid deserve to be fifth just because they've got Vinicius Junior, who's the most entertaining player in the world right now. Like, it's just like a highlight reel, isn't he? Every time he gets the ball, he's just doing something ridiculous to do to people. Yeah. Like, it's horrible. Yeah. Like, the prospect of who's going to be marking him? Yeah, whoever's marking him. Like, no, thank you.
Well, into number four then, and this does feel a little bit low for the reigning champions, but this is where Chelsea land. They've occupied top spot in the Premier League for longer than any other club has in this season, and they are the reigning champions. They were crowned champions back in May. So for fourth does feel a bit odd, but we're ranking them as we sit here right now in mid-December, and right now they're in a little bit of a wobble. Now, that is completely explainable. They have a Liverpool-style injury crisis in one specific position. All of their central midfielders can't play football. They're having to find solutions on the fly. They are getting some results as a result of that, but they are also conceding goals. They've conceded 8 in their last 3, which is quite a lot. It's more than they conceded in all the games up until that point. But it's explainable. That said, I can't just like brush it off and ignore it and say, well, no, just put them second, because right now they are in a little bit of an injury crisis. They do feel a little bit weaker than they should do. And they are feeling the loss of Ben Chilwell as well. So again, between now and February, maybe Chelsea stake a claim for one of those top 2 spots even and reassert themselves. But in the little weird kind of battle we've got with this top 3 English teams, Chelsea do actually feel like the third strongest in that little cluster, which I would not have said this time last month.
Yeah, there's a real kind of moment, isn't it? But, you know, and we can blame, well, we're not blaming it on anything. Blaming is the wrong word, but there is feasibility in that this is an injury crisis, right? And again, we talked about it a bit on Monday, but Chelsea's midfield injury crisis is a real problem at the moment, and it's impacting directly on the defensive elements of this team. Now, this team was built on solidity, and the fact that they didn't concede many, they won a lot of games 1-0 last year, right? They literally eked out results and made plenty of games tight and difficult and uncomfortable, and yet they got it done because they were so good. Now, they've conceded more than half of their goals for the season in December, which is not great if you're looking at where you're kind of falling apart in a little blip.
Well, you could say it was like the most ridiculous defensive record you could have imagined up to that point, though, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's what it was built on, right? It wasn't like it was an unsustainable defensive record, because it was so, you know, it was so well put together. And sometimes
expected goals against figures were ridiculously low. Yeah. They were consistently like 0.4, 0.3, 0.2.
So, you know, you're looking at a side who were defensively incredibly cohesive. They were watertight in so many ways. Now, without the midfield being able to cover them, we've seen that fall apart a little bit in recent weeks. Now, do I think that will come back? Yes, I think it will be fine. And I think that Chelsea will go on to kick on and have a good second half of the season. But on the whole, you know, this at the moment, they definitely do feel like the third strongest British side, I think. And you can only take this on what we're seeing right now, as we said, with kind of everything else. Chelsea threw away top spot in this group. Yes, they've got lucky with the draw twice. But when you look at it and you think that, you know, this is a Chelsea side who conceded 8 goals in 3 games, when, you know, and then they concede a last minute goal in the Zenit game to hand top spot to Juventus, and all of the above, right? We're looking at a team that doesn't quite feel as watertight as it did before, and therefore I think I completely agree with this, Sam.
Yeah. And into the top three here, this is actually one of the toughest ones to place, not in terms of where to go 1 to 16, but Bayern Munich in third. We all agree Bayern are top five. We probably all agree that Bayern are top three. But where in the top three or the top five do you put them? And honestly, I've settled for third. I can accept and entertain arguments for second, maybe even first. Maybe I could go as low as fifth. They really do feel like, obviously, they're really good. But how good? And it's difficult. It's genuinely difficult to figure it out because you don't have this comparison point yet. That's the beauty of the round of 16 and the quarterfinals, is Bayern probably end up meeting one of these teams, a Chelsea, a Man City, a Liverpool, a Real Madrid. And you get a really good comparison point for exactly where they are. But until that point, it is a little bit of speculation. It's a little bit of guesswork. And I think what has made me hold Bayern back from the top two, and these are fine margins, it's that they don't have one of the best managers in the world. They do have one of the future best managers in the world, but he's not quite there yet. And their centre-back pairing is just a little bit more prone to implosion than the others. And that's it. That's the deciding factor. That's all I can really pick at with Bayern Munich. And that's why they've ended up as third.
Yeah, I mean, last season it was like, they're going to win it. Like, they are the best team in Europe. They didn't win it. And this season, you're looking at them, and you don't have that quite, they don't have that inevitability about them that they did then. But, you know, we're at the stage of the season when perhaps that doesn't matter too much. They'll grow and get stronger. Obviously, the fact that Nagelsmann's there is a bit of an unknown. Like, I'll be convinced that Nagelsmann can manage them through this period and, like, through what's going to be, you know, a difficult set of fixtures, whoever they get from here to the run into the final, if they were to get there. Like, there's some big games to come, some big tests for him. And often he doesn't come through those tests when faced with them so far, albeit not with the quality of player he's had at his disposal right now. So there's a lot of unknowns there, as well as the fact that, you know, we know that Lewandowski can deliver if he's fit. And, you know, the core of this side is perfectly capable of winning the Champions League. At the moment, I think third is probably right for what we've seen.
Hmm. Yeah.
All right, good. I'm glad you've agreed, Dean. And I'll move into the top two. And it's the two English teams. And I'm sure people have figured that out as we've gone through, that it would be these two. But I guess the order is, it's a pick 'em, isn't it? It's a bit of a 50-50 at points. But at number two, I have placed Liverpool. So it's another team like Ajax and like Bayern Munich who have gone 6-for-6 in the group. They've been perfect. And it's funny because when we talk about the Premier League title race and we talk about these three teams in the Premier League title race, and we're looking for reasons to decry them. We're looking for, you know, nitpicking little reasons here and there to try and find edges that other teams might have. In Premier League parlance, that's AFCON. Liverpool are going to be hurt by the Africa Cup of Nations. They're going to lose Mane and Salah and Naby Keita if he's fit. That doesn't apply to the Champions League. It just doesn't. By February, they'll be clear. They'll have the best players in the world back in their team. They'll have the best player in the world this season back in their team. And look, I love the variation to their attack. I love the fact that they can go down the right and link with Trent and Salah. They can go down the left and use Robertson. They've got good dominance in the central areas. They've got an incredibly solid defensive line once again with Virgil van Dijk in there. Thiago's come on a level. Fabinho is still brilliant. There's not a weakness to pick out here for Liverpool in a Champions League context. There really isn't. And so for them to be second means that number one has to be basically perfect. And I think that's maybe what Man City have achieved so far this season. Pep Guardiola's Man City, they do. They feel like the strongest team in Europe for me right now. And that's a very simple formula for putting them top. Who do I think is the best team? Well, it's City. Incredible depth, brilliant system, some of the best players in the world in just ludicrous form. We're talking Cancelo and Bernardo there, but a couple more. And more than anything as well, the football they play is absolutely unreal. Now, there is nothing, almost nothing between City and Liverpool, in my opinion. And it really is like flipping a coin at points. But I'll take City. Me personally, I think they look like the strongest team in Europe.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Look, they are the best football team in Europe right now. If you were to get everyone at their very best, then Man City are the best team. Obviously, there's the fact that they've never won the Champions League that goes against them here, whereas Liverpool have got a history of going on and winning the Champions League. I think it does count for something. I really do. I think that having that knowledge in your head of like, we are a team that wins this competition, or oh no, this is where we fell short. I do think those little fragilities can get into the mind and play games as you get deep into this competition. And so I do worry about Man City in that sense once we're at semi-final stage. But like you say, like we can't, you know, that's just guesswork. And for what we're seeing on the pitch right now, Man City have got it all. And, you know, the guys, they always have somebody that steps forward, right? For Liverpool, most of the time, I know it sounds pretty harsh because they're a great football team, but they are quite reliant on Mo Salah stepping forward and providing like a perfect penalty, a match winning, you know, cuts inside Ben's one, whatever it is. Mo Salah usually can be relied on to provide that moment of magic. And it's not always him, but most of the time it is. With Man City, it's a bit more varied. It might be Cancelo, it might be Bernardo, it might be Raheem Sterling, Kevin De Bruyne, if he comes back into form, or whoever it is. Like, they kind of rotate that responsibility of stepping up. And I think that probably is what gives them the edge here. Although, as you say, there really isn't a lot between these sides. And if they were to play each other 10 times in a season, they'd probably win 5 each. Like, I really don't think there's anything between them.
They're almost perfect. They're perfectly built teams. Like, the two best managers in the world, for my money, with the two best squads or best 11s in the world. You know, it's just not, there's not a lot to pick between them. What a glorious situation to be in for an English football fan.
I mean, the fact they lost to PSG is a little concerning for Man City, because they shouldn't have lost that game.
No, it was a ridiculous game.
But that's Man
Bernardo
City.
Bernardo missed from 2 yards, Dean.
I know. And this is Man City in the Champions League, isn't it? This is the difference between City in the Prem and City in the Champions League, is those things tend to happen to them in the Champions League. Whereas Liverpool, if you were to put at like, you had a lot of money in like UK, you even put this on Man City or Liverpool, I would probably go Liverpool, because I just can rely on them a bit more. And I'd be waiting for Man City to do something stupid like that Bernardo miss to mess it up. Yeah. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, no, yeah. I get you.
I would have put Liverpool top as well, purely because, as you say, Sam, there is nothing between them as far as I'm concerned. If they meet each other, I have a thing that Liverpool have City's number a little bit. They're the only club, I think, in the world that really feel like they have City's number a bit at the moment. Even Chelsea, who obviously had a couple of good results against them last year, struggled against City this season. And it did feel in some ways that just that difference of Liverpool having been there and done that. And look, when it got to the end of this competition last year, I said City were the best team in the competition and probably should win it. This was the opportunity. And they didn't, right? They didn't get that over the line. Now, obviously, it's a game, a one-off game in knockout football. Anything can happen. It's very hard to use it as a barometer of who's the best team in where, because weird things happen in knockout football. You know, as Dean said, he thought Bayern were the best side, then Lewandowski got injured, then they got knocked out by PSG. Things like that happen. But when you're looking at this in that kind of response, I thought that City were the better side and last year and didn't do it. And for that reason, there's just that thing that hangs over them. And considering it's so tight between them and Liverpool, I would argue that Liverpool's caliber in this competition therefore gives them the slight edge. But as you say, there's nothing in it. That would really just be the way I'd have it round.
I'm just looking at the stats from when they actually played each other in October, and it was obviously Liverpool 2, Man City 2. They went 1-0, 1-1, 2-1, 2-2. And the stats, okay, Man City did have more shots than Liverpool in that game, but possession was 48-52. Passes, 501, 529. Like, usually you're not getting that kind of level in. Pass accuracy, 84% Liverpool, 83% Man City. Even like yellow cards, 3 each. Like, everything's the same. Like, this is two teams like that are just pretty much right there. And it's almost that a mistake is going to cost them. Like, this is what we've said before. Like, it's the little things that you can't expect in a game. Look at Chelsea. You're talking about the way that they've started to crumble defensively in recent weeks. Well, a lot of that has come down to individual error as well, whether it's Mendy and goal, whether it's Jorginho trying to bring a ball down against Man United and Sancho scores, whether it's Alonso giving the ball away little things like that can creep in and they start to skew the stats and they cost you games. And ultimately, you'd imagine that's what's going to happen to either Liverpool or Man City, to not win it rather than they get overrun by somebody.
Absolutely. I don't think it's possible to overrun either of these teams.
No.
So, yeah, forget that one for sure. But hey, there it is.
Nice.
That's the ranking.
We'll see how it compares in Feb.
Yeah, I'm looking forward absolutely. To looking forward to revisiting it already. Here we are. We've got a little matter of a transfer window and AFCON to get through before all that kicks off. But we will get there. Right after the break, we're going to be taking a brief look at the Europa League and the Europa Conference League before we move on to Melon of the Week and our gibberish rankings. Stay with us. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where we're going to be turning our focus from the Champions League, and thank you again to Sam for such a wonderful ranking, to the Europa League and the Europa Conference League, which, as many of you will know, are competitions very close to my heart. Before we do that, though, I just want to talk very briefly about a cause which has touched all three of us in recent days. One of our ultras, Ben, messaged us with a first-hand account of the tragic destruction which has wreaked havoc on his town and various other towns in Western Kentucky and beyond, and we felt compelled to share some of the relief causes that are happening across the states that have been devastated by the outbreak of tornadoes over there. So we've put a link in the description of this podcast for anyone that feels they want to try and lend a hand to the communities torn apart by events this weekend in the Midwest. To anyone listening in anywhere affected, please know that our thoughts are with you in what must be an incredibly difficult time, and that we hope there is light at the end of the tunnel and that listening has helped to take your mind off things too. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where it's time to take a little look at the Europa League and Europa Conference League draws that happened yesterday. We're not going to go through with the same fine-toothed comb that Sam has done because of the way that this competition has set up a little bit differently. And some of you will know that the format of both the Europa League and the Europa Conference League, obviously the Europa Conference League is new, but has changed this year, and they work on the same format, which is the teams who finished third in the competition above, so the Champions League, the Europa League and the Europa League for the Conference League, drop down to play in a playoff against the teams who finished second in the group, while the teams who win their group go straight through to the last 16. It's quite an exciting system, actually, and I actually think it improves the competition. Is quite a fun way of doing things, and it does give the teams who finish second, who then play at home in the second leg of those games, a little bit of an advantage against teams who are dropping down from a higher competition, which is a nice kind of element to things, I reckon. So that's for my money. It's a good change for the Europa League and a nice format for the Conference League. I'm going to do two mini rankings that basically wrap both into each other. We're going to do a best narratives ranking and a best matchups ranking. So we'll start with narratives. And at three in the Europa League, I've gone for Borussia Dortmund against Rangers. Now, there's a lot of players who have played for both clubs, but I think the best narrative here is that Gio Reyna is going to be playing against the man he was named after in Giovanni van Bronckhorst, who obviously played for Rangers with his father, Claudio Reyna, and then he was born, and they were very good friends, and so Gio was named after Giovanni van Bronckhorst, who is now the Rangers manager, of course. So not only is there this kind of element of a couple of players who've done both sides, and also this is going to be a game, I think, with an incredible atmosphere in both legs. Obviously, Rangers trying to return to, you know, a high point of European football, and Borussia Dortmund will feel like they have a point to prove after being dropped out of the Champions League relatively unceremoniously by Sporting. And so I think that the atmosphere in this is going to be incredible, but I am hanging my hat on the Gio Reyna part of this story, which I think is great fun. At two, we're going to drop in to the Europa Conference League briefly to talk about the fact that Maccabi Tel Aviv are playing PSV. In a game that I'm calling the Eren Zahavi Derby. Now, Eren Zahavi is PSV striker. He is Israeli. He has scored 15 or so goals in 37 games for PSV. He's got a relatively good strike record. He goes back to the club where he was made club captain in 2015-16. He has a wonderful history at Maccabi. His strike rate was absolutely ludicrous for them. He scored nearly 100 goals in 120 odd games. So it was a player who had won the hearts of his club. And then he went off to China for a couple of years and disappeared off the map and returned to PSV. So for him to go back to the club where he was club captain and is a real cult hero, I think is a magical narrative and something that maybe will have gone a little bit under the radar in the kind of big draws that happened yesterday. So I'm a big fan of that PSV Maccabi Tel Aviv game. On top of the list of the best narratives could only be one. Barcelona dropping into the Europa League and drawing Napoli in a game given to us by Diego Maradona from the heavens, I believe. Barcelona travelling to the Stadio Diego Armando Maradona to play in this, their first Europa League game in, well, a game in the second tier of European competition in nearly 20 years. Is something pretty remarkable, and for it to be at the Maradona against Napoli, two heavyweights and two mythical clubs of European competition, I think is just absolutely remarkable and kind of the draw that everyone wanted to see in many ways. I think we looked at it and went, you know, as soon as Napoli came out of the hat, you're like, go on. Given Barcelona, it comes out and you go, right, absolutely fantastic. A magical, magical moment.
It is the tie that you want to see. It's part of you goes, I want to see it later. But then there's no guarantees in this competition. You can't be like, no, save that for the semi-final, save that for the... That's not how it works. If you want to see a tie, you need to get it drawn out of the hat ASAP.
Also, the Europa League is constantly competing, you know, for kind of airtime and space with the Champions League, as we see, right? And you need games like this, big kind of headline games, in order to draw people in. Because the Europa League is a wonderful competition in its own right. Obviously, you don't mean me to tell you that. But it's one of those things where if the games tend to be, you know, Barcelona drawing smaller teams and progressing through, no one pays any attention until the quarterfinals and semifinals. Whereas getting this in a knockout playoff round before we even get to the last 16 is a massive draw for the competition, and I think that's got to be a good thing.
I think so. We got lucky last year, didn't we, with the Europa League, because Man United dropped in and they drew Milan immediately, and after that they took on, I'm forgetting who it was, Jack, but it was another big gun, wasn't it? They took on Roma.
Roma and then Ajax. No, Roma beat Ajax. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, and then they took on. So you've got Man United, Milan. Like Man United, Roma immediately. It's such a draw. It's so good for Thursday night.
It's a relatively impressive thing. And look, there's lots going to go on. And I think especially when we get to the round where obviously the teams have already qualified, especially even in the Conference League, where, you know, in the group stages, there's a lot of unknown quantities, right? Like a massive amount. And that's what the Conference League is about. It's about giving opportunities to clubs who might not have had that opportunity before. But also then we kind of flip back to actually where this is. You know, when it gets to the Europa Conference League knockout stages and to the last 16, there are going to be teams in there that people know and are well aware of, and that will, you know, give itself some kind of, well, I suppose, prestige as well in that regard. And you're talking about your Leicesters, you're talking about PSV and those kind of clubs. These are a massive kind of ties for and massive draws for the competition, and can only be a good thing, I think, in terms of making people watch. So there are those elements. And with that, I'm going to shift on to best matchups. And at three, we're going to start in the Europa League again. And we're going for RB Leipzig against Real Sociedad. Now,
nice.
That's a massive tie. That's a massive tie. And I think that when we talk about Leipzig and their bad start to the season, right, and we're looking at where how they came about and where it all came through and where things happened, you know, and then obviously Jesse Marsh was sacked, and since then they've been on a little bit of a charge themselves. And actually, if Leipzig had got through, if they'd been in a weaker group in the Champions League and they'd scraped through in the way that perhaps an Atleti did, right, then you'd be looking at Leipzig in that ranking beforehand, Sam, as a team with massive growth potential from here until February, because there's so much that felt untapped about this Leipzig side. And look, we love Jesse, but it just didn't work out in terms of matchups. Maybe it needed time. Maybe it needed a different style. We don't know. But ultimately, you know, we're looking at Leipzig as a side who are underperforming to this point. Now, Real Sociedad, a couple of weeks back, we were looking at as a Liga title contenders, right? Now, they were always going to fall away from that, we think. We always thought that there probably wasn't enough depth in this squad to carry through a genuine charge. But I'd imagine they're still going to be in the European conversation. They're still an incredible side. And taking Leipzig to Anoeta and to a stadium which will love this competition and really, really thrive on being in European competition, I think is an amazing tie. And I'm really, really excited to see what that one throws up. It's really the
Alexander Sørloth derby.
It is the Alexander Sørloth derby, correct. Well done. Very, very well done. At number two, I'm going to move down to the Conference League again. And I'm going to look at Bodø/Glimt against Celtic. Now, Bodø/Glimt are two-time Norwegian champions. Now, last year, they sprung a bit of a shock on everyone by going and winning the league. But arguably, I think this is more impressive. Their second title, they lost a couple of key players after that title win. The teams around them, the kind of traditionally strong teams, got stronger, and Bodø/Glimt held on and went and won another title, went back to back in obviously a very difficult scenario and a very difficult situation for everyone. But, you know, for especially for smaller clubs to try and stay on top, and they keep defying the odds, Bodø/Glimt. Obviously, then they went and beat Roma, or battered Roma in the group stages of this competition. They had the opportunity to win the group. They failed to take it. They're not infallible by any stretch of the imagination, but they are a very, very good side. And on their day, you know, as good as anyone. Celtic, on the other hand, are a kind of still working out exactly where they are under Ange Postecoglou. The signs are good. There are some lovely things going on. That relationship between Kyogo Furuhashi and Jota V3 is a very special one. And we're seeing some really, really nice stuff from Celtic at times, but it's not consistent yet. And I just think by February, this has the potential to be a really, really intriguing tie. Obviously, European nights under the lights at Parkhead, whatever competition it's in, are very special and have a real atmosphere about them. And I'm really excited to see how this one pans out. Obviously, that first leg at Parkhead is going to be massive, because to go to Bodø in the second leg, you're going to need something to hang on to. I'm intrigued to see how that one plays out. On top of this list, and probably the best game in either competition, I think, Porto versus Lazio feels incredibly nicely balanced. And Lazio have been strangely poor at times under Maurizio Sarri this year. And yet you look at this squad, you look at the caliber that it has, and the fact that it's still changing and moving away from that kind of Inzaghi ball towards what Sarri would want to play. Again, you're looking at a kind of Lazio in February as an intriguing prospect to see how, if they can finally make that work. Porto, on the other hand, will be upset that they've dropped down from the Champions League. It's a competition where they've made a mark into latter stages in recent years. Obviously locked out Juventus last year and made all that happen. But you go back and you go, right, okay, the last competition they won in Europe was actually the UEFA Cup the year after that Champions League. And you take to what that is and what it means, and you think that Porto, you're looking at this and going, you're probably one of the stronger sides in this competition now. There's a real chance that Porto go on and go deep into this competition if they want to. You know, we've seen them do it in Champions League. Can they drop down a level and get that over the line and push for an actual trophy? I think they can. So to get them up against Lazio in a first round, in a playoff round, is a big test of, one, how seriously you're going to take this, and two, if they really want to kick on and make a mark in this competition, how they can make their mark early doors. So I'm intrigued by this. And I think, you know, Barcelona and Napoli is the headline tie in terms of names and narrative. But actually, in terms of football spectacle, I think this one might be right up there with just as good a game.
Who's favourites to actually win the Europa League?
Well, I'd imagine the answer's Barcelona, but I don't actually know.
Well, they're not, though, are they? Like, they will be with bookmakers. But, like, who do you think is actually, like your
Dortmund
version,
must
I guess,
be a real shout here.
Hey?
Dortmund must be a proper shout here.
Yeah, it's got to be. I mean, it's very, very competitive. I mean, possibly more competitive than the Champions League in a way. Like, there's such quality. I mean, it also depends on, like, which sides really prioritise the competition. I mean, we know, like, in England, some teams, when they drop down, they still, like, don't take it that seriously. Do you think we're the only country left that does that?
Probably, yeah. Probably. And I actually think that they're obviously the teams who from England haven't dropped down. So the teams in it from England, well, obviously West Ham are the only team left in that regard, will be taking this incredibly seriously. They're fifth favourite. So it's Dortmund, Sevilla, Atalanta, Barcelona, West Ham, Leipzig, Napoli, Lyon, then Leverkusen. I fancy Leverkusen to have a real go at this, you know. They're a bit all over the place and they're a bit chaotic. But I do think that there's a real sense that in Europe, they have felt that they can blow teams away. And they did so. They won a very, very difficult group that qualified automatically. If Leverkusen, obviously, we don't know what the draw will be when it gets to that last 16. If Leverkusen get a favourable draw, first couple of rounds, and they can ease themselves into it, I fancy them to make a real mark on this.
There's 10 teams there. 10, like, you can win this team.
Yeah, that's what I was Big thinking. Time. Yeah, it actually is more competitive, isn't it? Because even though you're, you know, the top 10 for the Champions League is strong, technically they can all win it. But those 10, like, there's not a lot between them.
And for the record, just to
and then you drop down
off,
underneath that, Monaco, Real Sociedad, Lazio, Real Betis are third in La Liga, Frankfurt just beat Leverkusen 5-2. Then you're talking Zenit, Galatasaray. These are teams that, you know, can, you know, if they get through, obviously, this is a first tricky bit, but, you know, you're looking at teams who can really make a difference and some traditional European giants. The likes of Galatasaray, right? Who you don't want to go to Gala not on a lead, right? You're not gonna fancy that in a two-legged knockout tie to have to go, and with that atmosphere and the kind of intimidating atmosphere that Gala provides.
You deserve away goals at Galatasaray.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the only place you get it.
Yeah. I mean, guys,
it's really intriguing.
Guys, just to close this off, I mean, just to put on record, we do not appreciate the attitude towards these competitions, the Europa League and the Europa Conference League, that Brendan Rodgers has taken, where he says that, you know, after 6 months of its existence, he admitted that he doesn't even know what the Europa League Conference actually is as a competition. I mean, Leicester have dropped into it, so you better figure it out quick, buddy. But these are important. These games are important. These competitions are important, and they should be important to these teams. And the large majority of the names that Jack and Dean have just read out is, yeah, about 16 teams there. They'll be taking it seriously, and this is going to be a real spectacle heading into 2022.
Yeah, he's dismissing it for a reason. He's not going to take it seriously, and he's going to go straight out like he did in Europa. He should have won the Europa League last season. He shouldn't have got knocked out of that when he did.
Yeah, they fell apart in a very odd game with Slavia Prague.
Slavia, wasn't it?
But yeah, Leicester were favourites at that point, and they were favourites at the start of this season. And look where they are now.
This is the thing. That's why
the rule is. Don't make Leicester favourites for anything. They only win things when they're 5,000 to 1. And on that bombshell, we're going to call this little segment a day. And we are going to come back after the break with our Melon of the Week and the Gibberish Rankings. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks FC. It's time for everybody's favourite part of the week. Dean Jones, the floor is yours. And to be honest, you've got a selection box to choose from this week.
Oh my goodness. What a stupid last week we've seen in football. Not just in football even. I might throw F1 into the mix here. but I'm sticking to traditional methods of picking my Melon of the Week. So here we go. It's time for Melon of the Week. This week's Melon of the Week is Raul Jimenez.
Hey.
Because no matter what else has gone on, no matter what UEFA have tried to do, no matter that Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang has just been stripped of the captaincy at Arsenal for more disciplinary issues, we cannot overlook what Raul Jimenez has done on a football pitch to affect his team from getting a positive result at Manchester City. So in the space of 31 seconds, first half seconds as well, Jimenez picks up two yellow cards, which results in a sending off. His first, a foul on Rodri, where he's just breaking up play, really. It's a bit of a silly one. But then, just can't accept it and stand in front of the free kick. And look, we've seen people stand in front of balls many times before. Like, it doesn't happen as much anymore because people know that they're going to get a yellow for it if the bloke suddenly kicks the ball at them. And look, Jimenez stands there. For some reason, he's trying to block the pass. What are you doing? What are you possibly doing? You know the rules. Bruno Lage not happy with him afterwards. He says he knows he cannot do that. You've got to take the yellow card. But yeah, Jimenez doesn't accept it. He blocks. The referee pulls him up on it. He gets his second yellow card. And Jimenez then takes a lifetime, really, to actually come to terms with what's going on. And
this is really weird. There was a really good
headband play at work.
There was a really good tweet from Musa Okwonga actually here saying that watching this happen, watching Raul Jimenez leave the pitch was basically like watching the five stages of grief play out. Because first of all, he absolutely cannot believe it. And to be fair to him, this stuff is against the rules, but it's very rarely called up on. I know he's a bit he exaggerates and he's a bit obvious, but the very next day, I watched Seamus Coleman foul someone and then dive onto the ball and hold onto it with his hands to prevent a quick free kick, and he got nothing.
He just fell over. I have no idea what you meant. He tripped himself over and he accidentally landed on the ball. There was nothing wrong with that.
And accidentally grabbed it. So I understand that the denial there from Raul Jimenez is like, and he's like, what the hell? How can this possibly be happening? Then it settles in and you get the anger. Then he starts to bargain with the referee. Then he's walking off. he's walking off the pitch and he throws his headband on the floor and then takes his gloves off and then starts to throw his gloves on the floor and pick them back up again. So the City fans start going, "Whoa," and going, "Wait," when he throws his glove back on the floor. And then there's a grin on his face as he eventually realizes what's happened, tricks the crowd, fakes the throw, gets them to go, "Way," when he doesn't actually do it. And that's the acceptance. And there you go. Inside 1 minute.
What was he doing?
Minute. Mate, he's ridiculous. What Absolutely ridiculous.
Fun, though. I mean, not fun for Wolves fans. I apologise. But fun for everyone else. I mean,
you know, they only lost 1-0 to a penalty as well. Like, if you had Jimenez on the pitch for a second half, might have actually picked up a surprise point or maybe three. Like, just such a hard thing to do to play Man City anyway because they're going to have all the ball. And to do it with 10 men is, well, they certainly wouldn't have got any thank yous from his teammates who would have been absolutely shattered afterwards alongside him. But really, really melanish stuff that.
It's like giving yourself a dead leg and then challenging Usain Bolt to a 100-meter race.
That's a lovely analogy. Well done. Well done. And well done, Dean, because picking one there was no easy task this week. You had a plethora of options.
Traditional methods of just someone who's acted like a melon on a football pitch.
Absolutely. It's the gibberish alarm.
It is. It is indeed. I mean, so this week, I'm a week late on this one. I know Spotify Wrapped was a bit last week, but I just forgot to do it last week. And then I had a couple of people on Discord and a couple of requests saying, "Hey, you said you were going to do it. You didn't do it." So, hey, a week late, but we get to it. And, you know, last week we did this last year we did this. And, last year I did top songs. Do you remember? And, unfortunately, it was a really embarrassing one at the top, which I don't want to relive. It would be pointless for me to do top songs this time around because the entirety of the top five are Kid Cudi songs from the same album. And this and this was my shame. At number three was Another Day. At number two was Tequila Shots. And at number one was Sad People. All three are from Kid Cudi's latest album, Man on the Moon 3, which is an amazing album, obviously. Spotify tells me that I have listened to that album 78 times this year.
When was it released?
A couple of years ago. Either early this year or late last year. So it is a recent one. But obviously, there's something in me that just kind of continues to go back to that as like a comfort mechanism.
Was it released in lockdown and you're just harping back to those days?
Do you know what, actually? So during the initial lockdown, do you remember The Weeknd brought out his new album?
Yeah.
And that was right up there for me as well, just because like, what else was I going to do? So
Isn't it funny though, now there are some songs that literally take you back to lockdown. There's some weird stuff happening there in music, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. When I listened to The Weeknd's album, I then imagined myself in my kitchen playing Football Manager during the first lockdown.
That's what you did for 3 months.
That's what I did. Yeah, that's all I did. But anyway, it'd be useless to go top songs because it's all Kid Cudi. So I was like, okay, we'll do top artist instead. Guess who the top artist is?
Yeah, I don't know.
Could be anyone, couldn't it? Mm. Obviously, it's Kid Cudi. So maybe we'll do 5-2 and we'll just ignore Kid Cudi. But number five, and I feel differently about these different ones, but number five is Post Malone, who I continue to go back to. He's never quite hit the heights of Stony, his first album, but I'd say he's a pretty consistently decent artist. And I think I saw him in a film the other day, or I saw an advert for him in a film. So well done, Posty. You're really expanding your horizons.
Congratulations. He's a double threat now.
Yeah, it's a really strong couple of years in the music game, moving into the film game, basically the new Eminem. And at number four is obviously Drake Is Here. Is it because he's on every track?
I wondered this because Drake popped up in my top five and I don't think I actively listen to that much Drake.
But it's unavoidable, isn't it? It just comes in.
I like Drake loads, but I just don't.
He's done so many collaborations. No matter who you like to listen to, Drake pops up on there.
Yeah,
seek him out. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's bizarre.
He's just featured on everything, isn't he? He's just, as you say, he's just kind of ever present in the background as one of three contributing artists. You go back 60 years and look at some really old music and you'd be surprised actually. If Drake's actually on those tracks. You just didn't realize it at the time. At number three, Milburn.
Wow.
Now this is interesting.
Just because we had a conversation about it or something.
How much did you listen to them after that?
I always listened to them, but this is interesting because this might be the most heated I've ever seen Jack Collins when I turned around to him and said that Milburn were better than the Arctic Monkeys.
It's one of the worst takes I've ever heard.
I've never seen a man more incensed. And I stand by it. I prefer them, clearly, because Arctic Monkeys are not in my top five, but Millburn are third. I prefer to listen to Millburn over Arctic Monkeys.
I mean, launched at the same time-ish, didn't they? And I remember
Yeah, they're just like
one
very...
One went on to take over the world, the other one didn't.
And there was a reason for that.
Yeah.
There's a big reason for that, and that one of them was, you know, a versatile, exquisite artist, and the other one was Millburn.
Nah.
Millburn's first album was great. I'll give him that.
I've got two words for you, Jack. Millburn robbed. Millburn robbed. Number two, or by virtue of this ranking, number one, because Kid Cudi is excluded, is Above and Beyond. And you cannot be surprised by that.
Not surprised
at all.
It was
always going to be Above and Beyond. Now, that is a genuine one where I go back and listen to it when I need soothing. It's very soothing. And the thing that they've nailed down is that they've done all their songs in a trance style, and then they've done them all again in acoustic. So it doesn't matter what mood you're in, you can always listen to them.
Nice.
Yeah, nice.
And then you're listening to acoustic music and trance music and dance music, and it all feeds into the same artist. So they're number two.
Mm. Yeah, well, enjoy these Spotify Wrapped lists before you have children, because once you do, they are an absolute mess.
How high is Peppa Pig?
So I've got like The Wiggles, Peppa Pig, Happy Birthday. Reese's favourite song is Happy Birthday. So we go on car journeys just with Happy Birthday on repeat, and he just sits there smiling and goes, happy, happy.
This is great value. This is much better. I was going to read mine out, but I'm not now. This is much better. We just stay with
exactly,
Dean's.
Yeah. And then mixed among that, you get some actually decent music, but it doesn't matter anymore. I'm irrelevant.
Yeah, bit of Millburn in there with the old birthday.
Yeah. I was saying, it's the Rifles and Happy Birthday for Dean. That's where we know we're at.
Rifles, DMAs, Cortinas, Peppa Pig, Wiggles, Happy Birthday.
Happy days. mine was a bizarre mix of just like very, very London-centric like hip-hop and... Sure. Really odd Celtic folk music.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. My top three were the High Kings in third, who are a four-piece Irish folk band, basically. And then The Manor are two. The Manor weren't top of my Spotify Wrapped for the first time in 5 years. They were usurped this year.
Have you apologised?
I texted them to say sorry. And then their band called Real Lies were top this year, who are very, very good. I enjoy Real Lies a lot. So there you go. If you want to find out what my sound is like, Real Lies are pretty heavily involved in it.
Is that Irish folk stuff? Is that the one where you sing the same verse over and over again, but much quicker? I've seen you do that a few times.
Oh, the Rattling Bog. No, I haven't done the Rattling Bog. No, that's not them. But
top three? It should be.
No, it's in my top three songs, but it's not my top three artists. So right. It's important. Okay. It's important to give that. Also, the other song that popped up in my top five songs at four, but it was also the song that I've said, like the song you've gone back to almost individually, you know, you've played on repeat most times, is Jungle Land by Bruce Springsteen, which I wasn't expecting at all. Mm. And I was a bit confused. I love Jungle Land, but it's also like 8 minutes long and it has like changes course about four times in the middle of it. So I wasn't quite expecting that, but it's the song I've played on repeat most times, but also it came fourth in the songs you have played, if that makes more, if that makes any sense. But yeah, excellent. Well done everyone. Very, very good. I'm glad we got the shouts out there, and thank you to everyone, by the way, who sent us lovely DMs or tweets or Instagrams with us as in your Spotify Wrapped in the podcast bit, because they're always much appreciated, and we love seeing them roll in. So thank you, we very much
that was a well nice day, wasn't it?
It's watching a lovely all them day roll in. It's a really nice day. You're like, oh, people listen to us, this is good, this is nice.
It's like handy that. Yeah,
it's useful.
There are people out there,
we do appreciate it.
Hang on, we should actually say, like, Christmas is coming up, like, ask for a Christmas present. You can actually get an annual subscription to Patreon now.
That is important.
So Jack, you explain more about that, because I don't know how it works exactly, but that's actually quite a good Christmas present for some of the rank squad.
Yeah, if you're looking to get involved with the Patreon and get involved with the ultras, you can get an annual subscription on the Patreon now, so it's not month by month, or you can go month by month, to be honest. But if you're looking to get more involved, get our Monday and Friday podcasts, and join in with the ultras community with ranks, then you can definitely ask for that for Christmas. You go patreon.com/ranksfc, and all the details are in there for you to come and get involved. So yeah, if you fancy becoming into the inner circle of the rank squad, we'd love to have you. We'd love to have you.
Do
you
want to send a Christmas present? Would be that subscription along with a hoodie, a shirt, a zip-up tracksuit top, all from New Balance in that shop now.
There he is, our top salesman, Dean Jones.
And I'll send you a signed photo for £5.
I was going to say, if you want to give us a Christmas present, we'd really appreciate if you left us a review on iTunes. Mm. If you listen to us on iTunes, that would be very much appreciated in this festive season. It gives us a boost. It helps new people find us. It's just a really useful thing to have. So if you do fancy giving us a little Christmas present, a review would be much appreciated on iTunes. And with that, I think we're going to call this a day, ladies and gentlemen. All that's left for me to do is to say thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much to Sam Tye.
Cheers, buddy.
Thank you very much to Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you again for listening. We really, really do appreciate it. We'll be back next week with our Christmas special, which will be, well, a couple of days before Christmas, but it's the closest release date to Christmas Day. We hope you're having a wonderful festive period wherever you are in the world. Take it easy, Ranks Squad. Peace.